if you were king of the world, what would you be doing right now?
Talking to you, obviously. I'm a great advocate of the need to reverse climate change. I don't think that climate change is our grandkids' problem. I don't think it's our children's problem. I think it's our problem. I think we'll see the consequences of climate change in our lifetime and the negative effects of climate change. It's this generation that needs to do something about it.
Welcome back to the Zero Pressure podcast series, a relaxed conversation with those on the cutting edge of science and technology, hosted by me, Helen Sharman, and presented by Imperial College London and Saab. The Zero Pressure podcast looks at how science and technology positively can contribute to solving complex, global, interrelated challenges of today and tomorrow. This time, we're talking about how hydrogen can contribute to a carbon net zero economy. Hydrogen is a gas at standard conditions. The sun is made mainly of hydrogen gas, but on Earth, we find most of hydrogen bonded to oxygen as water, H2O. To get hydrogen gas, we can split the water molecules, and that takes energy. But when hydrogen and oxygen are recombined, electricity is produced, along with some heat and clean water. It's a technology full of potential for a carbon net zero economy. I'm very pleased to be joined on Zero Pressure by our guest, Dr. Andy Palmer, an engineer and automotive executive who's chief executive of electric bus and van manufacturer Switch Mobility, chairman of Innobat, which develops intelligent batteries for electric vehicles, and founder of the Palmer Foundation that funds apprenticeships for young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, amongst other executive roles that he has. Andy's previously served as chief executive of Aston Martin Lagonda and chief operating officer of Nissan, where he led the development of the Nissan Leaf electric car. He supports a variety of organisations within the net zero transportation space and advises the UK government recently on the role hydrogen can play in reaching net zero. Andy, welcome to Zero Pressure. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. It's great. It's a lovely opportunity. Thanks for inviting me.
Have you always been into cars?
Oh, yes. Ever since I can remember. Ever since sitting in the back of my dad's car on motorways, trying to beat my dad in terms of recognizing which car was which. And my father very much became the responsibility for me becoming an engineer. He bought an old scrap A-series engine when I was 14. And sort of between the ages of 14 and 16, I was constantly stripping that engine down and rebuilding it and not really understanding how an engine would work. And that created then my eagerness to become an automotive engineer as quickly as I could, which was really to leave school at 15 and take an apprenticeship at 16. And I was on a drawing board designing things, mainly clutches and brakes and gearboxes, at the age of 20 as a first grade engineer. So and that pursuit has either plagued or been within my life for my whole life. At dinner parties, I can bore everybody with ridiculous things around the cars and the car industry, but can barely talk about anything else.
But how lovely to have a chief executive who actually started off as an apprentice, really manual stuff with your hands and stripping apart engines. I love that. But when did you first get involved in the electric part of, the electric vehicles and perhaps green transportation more generally?
Goes back probably 16 years now. I was chief planning officer, eventually chief operating officer of Nissan. I was 23 years with Nissan, and 13 years of those were living in Japan. And at that time, I have to say Toyota were kicking the butt of Nissan, particularly with a car called the Prius. Prius was really, really the first commercially successful hybrid. And our sales team, the Nissan sales team, particularly those in Japan, were crying out, wanting to have the Nissan Prius. It struck me at the time, and I think proven correctly, that just following Toyota wasn't the right thing to do. Doing a Me Too would have ended in the same way as it did for Honda, which was not particularly successful with the Insight. What I wanted to do was take a leapfrog technology, and there was sufficient knowledge deep in the engineering world inside Nissan, partially because of what was called compliance cars for California. It was a good understanding of pure battery electric vehicles. And so we basically conceived this all-electric a car that eventually became the Nissan Leaf and was essentially the first modern-day electric vehicle, and for many years was by far the top seller. That's the story of the Leaf, and I was it's sort of in my portfolio of what I call children, so car children. I would say that it defines one bookend of my career, probably with Valkyrie, which is an Aston Martin, defining the other bookend, and you know, all of these array of children in between. But Leaf most certainly was the most challenging of projects that I've ever done.
Now that makes me think of the subject that this podcast is really about, which is hydrogen. And of course, there are many cynics about hydrogen worldwide, especially when it comes to transport, I guess, because many countries have gone quite a long way down this electric vehicle route. I mean, what brought you to hydrogen as well as electric vehicles?
So I led both teams in Nissan. Well, almost at the same time, we also had essentially a collaboration with Mercedes-Benz and Ford to develop fuel cells, specifically fuel cell vehicles at the time. And I would say there was a little bit of Darwinism going on to see which would get to market quickest and be most successful. And of course, the answer to that question is proven. It was EV. Hydrogen has, well, first of all, hydrogen has an absolutely critical part to play in the move of the planet towards net carbon zero. So I think there are almost too many activities and technologies where you have to use hydrogen that perhaps the automotive industry is a little bit down the pecking list. But within that, you also have to recognize that you need to create clean hydrogen. So there's no point, if you will, in taking what sometimes is called gray hydrogen, which is a byproduct of oil and gas. You've got to move to either blue hydrogen, which is basically with the CO2 element essentially taken out and stored, or to the green hydrogen, which is basically the production of hydrogen without the use of CO2. Ultimately, the problem is that green hydrogen represents today about 1% of the production of hydrogen, and we need it to be closer to 100%. And I guess that's probably what's held hydrogen back. Also, the technology is expensive. Fuel cell technology today, it's not started to make its way down the Moore's curve. Whereas EV is obviously a little bit in advanced and is becoming more affordable. However, I do think that there are areas where hydrogen starts to become very interesting. If I crystal ball to the future, which means I'll inevitably be wrong, but I would imagine that the majority of what the US calls light vehicles will be EV, because EV is thermodynamically more efficient. But as a vehicle gets bigger and heavier, the battery electric system is less efficient. So particularly for heavy trucks, there is a much more compelling argument towards eventually fuel cell, and maybe in the interim, something called hot hydrogen. And what I like about hot hydrogen is that you're using an internal combustion engine, or at least 80% or 90% of an existing internal combustion engine, so the capex is already spent, and you're combusting hydrogen and oxygen, and obviously producing water as a result. But that's a means that you can get to a hydrogen powered vehicle actually very quickly. And if you look at the economics of that, that form of propulsion has about the same cost as a Euro 7 diesel. So it's comparative on cost, but it's basically clean. That doesn't overlay, of course, the cost of hydrogen and the cost particularly of getting to green hydrogen, but I think it's quite an interesting bridging technology for the fuel cell. The other area where I think Darwinism is going to play out is coming from the aerospace industry. And I think one of the interesting technologies is synthetic fuel, which of course is not zero emission at the tailpipe, but basically is a balanced net zero because you're taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and creating fuel from it. And I think insofar as that works or appears to work for aerospace, it could also work, for example, in supercars or sports cars, where perhaps you still want to have the roar of the engine. So I think the border, if you say that the majority of light cars becomes EV because it's the most thermally efficient means of propulsion, but around the edges, maybe medium trucks, certainly heavy duty trucks, maybe aerospace, maybe supercars, maybe sports cars, what you're having, you're allowing different technologies to compete against each other. And as we know, that's when innovation is at its highest. That's when you get the best out of your engineers. And that's when side effects start to come into effect. Alternative ways of propelling vehicles. And perhaps 10 years from now, there's a technology that we haven't even heard of yet. And that's what I love about engineering. And that's when I'm talking to politicians, I plead with them not to simply look just at electric vehicles. You've got to allow engineers and scientists to innovate.
I totally appreciate what you're saying about electric vehicles not maybe working up to the heavier and the longer haul kind of transport. I don't quite understand why hydrogen technology, fuel cell technology, and possibly the hot hydrogen that you mentioned, when we're actually burning it directly. Of course, that sounds just like a rocket to me. So it sounds a pretty good use of your hydrogen without having to go through those losses of converting it back into electricity, I suppose. But why can't we use hydrogen more in the light vehicle market?
So technically, it's clearly possible. And you can see, for example, Toyota has a car on the road today, which is using a fuel cell. So technically, it's absolutely achievable. The constraint comes in cost and the refueling network. And that's, I think, is where the battleground is. Cost. If I told you that the majority of cars sold today on their purchase price don't make any money. Most of them actually make negative profit. They make a loss. And the car companies, when they make money generally speaking from after service parts and sales financing. So margins on any car are razor thin. And so when you bring new technologies, you have to be acutely aware of the cost implications. And generally speaking, there isn't the appetite within the consumer to pay extra for the technologies you're getting. So that's the first point, is that for hydrogen to have a place, then basically you've got to have sufficient volume that basically you can bring the cost down. I think that's key. The second point is one of refueling distribution. And you can see the issue of this even with electric cars, that, you know, there are insufficient number of charging points, but the cost of a hydrogen station is a magnitude higher than an electric station. And until we know this from the electric car, until you have numbers of hydrogen refueling stations around, people have essentially range anxiety, and it's a barrier to entry. So I think those are the two biggies that maybe preclude hydrogen as a solution. It is worth saying, of course, that if you look at thermodynamic efficiency, if you talk about a gasoline engine gasoline engine is about 29 or 30% efficient. Everything else disappears in heat, essentially. If you look at a BEV, a battery electric vehicle, it's about 90% efficient. A fuel cell is somewhere in between. So there are some scientific reasons why there might be a bias towards electric vehicles at the lighter end. As I say, basically that doesn't fit so well as you get to the heavier end, because you need big and heavy batteries, and that doesn't really work on a HGV. So I think that opens the door, and as long as you open the door to hydrogen, you can start moving the costs down those Mohr's curve and give it an opportunity to compete.
So the cost, as I understand it, the platinum catalyst that we have to at the moment employ, which enables us to convert hydrogen into water by adding oxygen, that the platinum and then the nickel catalyst, that they're both quite expensive. So is it a question of getting rid of that catalyst?
You take a particularly good subject. The use of raw materials is, in the case of electric vehicles and in the case of hydrogen vehicles, is one of the key and critical issues. And moving to lower cost metals, or finding alternatives to those metals, is usually one of the keys. I can take you all the way back to the 1990s and Euro 1. And the amount of precious metal being used in catalysts at the time, and that made catalysts extraordinarily expensive. They're still expensive, but basically by modifying the materials and reducing the amounts of materials, then basically catalysts became much more value based and allowed Euro 1 costs to be achieved without a detriment to vehicle profitability. We're seeing exactly the same trajectory with electric vehicles right now, with a lot of work, as you know, going around reducing the amount of cobalt, for example, in the batteries, and increasing the amount of silicon, for example. And the same is true of the fuel cell evolution. The point is that you need to start. You need to have and start to build volume. And I think fuel cell volume growth will start probably at the heavier end of the market, where the electric car is less efficient.
I'll come back to Andy shortly. Professor Laura Gagliardi is a theoretical and computational chemist. Her research focuses on the development of electronic structure methods and their use for understanding catalysis, amongst other things. Laura is the Richard and Kathy Leventhal Professor at the University of Chicago, and she's the director of the Chicago Center for Theoretical Chemistry.
As you said in the introduction, I am a theoretical chemist. To some people, this may sound strange. What does it mean? So this means that we are, instead of trying to realize these reactions, these processes in a lab, we try to model them, simulate them on a computer. And so we are studying, for example, various ways of reactions involved in the hydrogen transport. So attaching, detaching hydrogen to some carriers. And the idea of modeling these reactions on the computer is that we can just try many different things that maybe setting up in a lab are very expensive, not of immediate realization, and guide the people who will then make physically these experiments towards what are good directions and not. So we can have a role of understanding certain properties, but also predict future properties, future behaviors. And in an era in which, for example, data science, machine learning are emerging, this becomes very important, because we can really advance discoveries and explore chemical spaces that otherwise would be hidden.
How do you think hydrogen could be used in the future?
from steel mills to cement production and beyond. So hydrogen is being recognized as an energy source. And certainly a possible future use is in cement production. So the idea is to basically replace the current use of coal as a reducing agent with hydrogen. Of course, the problem in this case is that this leads to the production of porous raw iron, which has then to be treated and sintered subsequently. So it's not that everything is super easy and implementable right away. So it will take time to make these technologies more effective.
Thank you to Laura Gagliardi. And now let's go back to Andy Palmer. What do you think about using a carrier for hydrogen, as Laura mentioned, when hydrogen is attached to something like a liquid hydrocarbon? So hydrogen then can be transported as if it were a liquid. I mean, could you see that kind of technology replacing fuel cells in the future?
Yes. I mean, that speaks perfectly to there will be innovations that we don't even know about today that will be relevant in 10 years from now, which is why we should never, ever close out our minds to alternatives. And again, I reiterate that it's a great point in front of, if there's any politicians listening, you know, basically don't pin all your hopes on one technology. That's what we did with diesel engines. And we forgot that every technology has a side effect. There always will be unintended consequences from a certain technology. Take battery electric vehicles, the use of cobalt, the use of nickel, the geopolitical issues around rare earth. Every technology you take will always have an unintended consequence, and you've got to let the scientists and the engineers continue to innovate their way around it. Transportation of hydrogen, incidentally, is one of those key technology drivers. You've got to be able to distribute it. You've got to get it out to the charging stations, and that is indeed one of the key challenges.
What technology do we need to develop in order to let us transport hydrogen more effectively? And I guess that means safely as well, does it?
Yeah. Gasoline isn't exactly the safest thing to transport around either, but we've been doing it for years. So I'm sure that we'll always find solutions to safe transportation. The question is one of efficient transportation and the medium in which you transport a hydrogen. And you know, there are many different ideas of how that might be, but clearly you need to be as efficient, slightly better, slightly worse than the transportation of gasoline. So you've got the kind of gold standard today in how we move petrol and diesel around.
Do we need countries and perhaps other international organisations to incentivize us to invest in new technology, possibly hydrogen technology? Or do you think we should just allow the engineers and the scientists to do this this Darwinism, as you've kind of alluded to before, but to develop stuff on their own? Because we might go in a completely different direction if that were the case.
I think you only have to look at places like China and Norway, two complete extremes, but where the government has intervened with incentives around the achievement of net carbon zero. I think it works better where you're technology agnostic, as long as what you're doing is on the roadmap to net zero. But you have to distort the market to change the market. And Norway has been, in particular, has shown that by distorting the market, suddenly almost every car in Norway is now an electric car. And it's traveled in that direction extremely efficiently. What you see, and we can look to the UK now, where you had incentives and then you stopped incentives, you're still on a trajectory of move towards electric vehicles, but not at the same pace. So I think it's a measure of a government's commitment to its COP targets and its belief in the need for net carbon zero. I think you have to put your money where your mouth is as a government. And that, generally speaking, should be incentives for the consumer to move to net carbon zero, but should be technology agnostic.
You mentioned earlier sort of the grey, blue and green hydrogen, and obviously the green one is the cleaner one because we're electrolysing water to produce hydrogen. And so we're not then producing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in that way. You also mentioned that
yes,
hydrogen isn't only wanted to be used in vehicles, that there's a lot of other industry that uses hydrogen. So where else is using hydrogen and that might benefit from green hydrogen?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of places where hydrogen can be used, building, heating and power, industrial energy, new feedstock uses, power generation. So there's a lot of I would say demand for hydrogen, and I think that's why you have to go through this grey, blue, green transition in order to get basically all of those industries sort of hooked to the idea of using hydrogen. Green hydrogen, of course, as you would expect, is the most expensive. And somewhere there's a crossover point. Most projections are wrong because by nature they're wrong. But you start to look to blue and green parity of cost somewhere between 2035 and 2040. So that's the kind of timescale that we're talking about. And therefore, I think we shouldn't discard grey hydrogen because it has a hydrocarbon basis. I think it's the feedstock for moving various industries over towards electric, if you like, not dissimilar to eco petrol engines moving to hybrid, moving to plug-in hybrid, moving eventually to electric. You have that. You have this 20-year transition, and to some extent, the other industries need to go through that, and hydrogen therefore does have a roadmap that could allow that to happen.
So we need to bring down the cost of green hydrogen eventually. That means producing it presumably at scale and more cheaply. What are the barriers to doing that at the moment?
Volume, I think. So at scale is where you get economies of scale. And therefore you need usage. And it's always this conundrum, why were electric vehicles so darned expensive 15 years ago? It was because nobody bought them, and therefore you didn't get the economies of scale. I think that probably the same is true for hydrogen, is that you need the use cases, and you need to work out the chicken and the egg, to all intents and purposes, what's going to drive the demand.
And of course, we shouldn't forget that green hydrogen is only green if the electricity that we use to separate the hydrogen from the water, if that electricity is produced in a green way. Do you think that the political and sort of regulatory landscape is set up well enough at the moment to facilitate all this development of green hydrogen? And the use of it, of course, as well.
No, not at all. But it's also not surprising. It's still nascent technology, and even if you look at electric vehicles, not everything is perfectly formed either. So I think to some extent regulation tends to follow implementation. In other words, you find the new needs as you go and introduce and learn. So I think the answer is no, but I don't think it's unexpected that it's behind.
The world showed how we could collaborate and develop a COVID vaccine really, really quickly when we chose to. Vaccines normally take 10 years. We did it in less than two. Amazing. I bet if we really wanted to, we could do it in a few years. We'd be there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, I talk to politicians and they ask me whether you can get electric buses on the road by 2035. And I say, I can get electric buses on the road. I can replace the whole fleet by 2025 if you have the political will to want to make it happen.
Quickly, before you disappear, just some quick fire questions for you. What do you see as the most exciting project involving green hydrogen at the moment?
I think I have to go for the more boring stuff, which is basically around the production of green hydrogen at a cost that makes it affordable.
And given that we're not really forcing a very rapid worldwide collaborative venture into giving up petrol and diesel, pragmatically, when do you actually think we will stop using petrol and diesel for most transport?
2030. And the reason isn't because necessarily the customer wants it. It's because there isn't a vehicle OEM today who are developing a new gasoline engine.
If you were king of the world, what would you be doing right now?
Talking to you, obviously. look, I'm a great advocate of the need to reverse climate change. I don't think that climate change is our grandkids' problem. I don't think it's our children's problem. I think it's our problem. I think we'll see the consequences of climate change in our lifetime and the negative effects of climate change. And in some respects, maybe that's good because it's this generation that needs to do something about it. Whether we look at the floods around the world or the wildfires, you know, these are consequences and they're only going to get worse. And so for me, you know, if I were king of the world, then basically what I'd be looking at is not a time horizon of 2050 or 2070, but a time horizon of 2025, 2030. I think it's important that the world, its scientists, its politicians, its engineers, dedicate their capabilities and intellectual properties towards changing the way that we use energy. We've got to save the planet because we live here and we don't have any alternative.
And finally, can you see us using hydrogen really widely to meet a multitude of energy needs?
Without doubt. Hydrogen is if there is something that is close to a silver bullet for climate change, it's probably hydrogen.
Thank you, Andy. You have given us a fascinating insight into this very complex world of hydrogen.
This might be my great pleasure, and I hope your listeners enjoy it.
Andy spoke about hydrogen being used as clean energy, so long as the hydrogen itself is produced in a clean way, as well as hydrogen being one of the fuels for transport. He said that we need to consider a network of technologies rather than focusing on any one solution, that every technological advancement has unknown consequences, and we need to trust scientists to innovate. And thank you for joining us on this podcast discussion. Do listen in to the upcoming episode of Zero Pressure Podcast next month, which will be about positioning, navigation, and timing services. An example is the Global Positioning System, GPS, that we use for a multitude of endeavours, like farmers mapping their crops or airline pilots navigating the sky. These services are provided by a global navigation satellite system, which together with the positioning, navigation, and timing services is highly important for our national critical infrastructures, as well as for defence interests. Next time, we'll talk about the challenges and the opportunities for these services and the technology behind them. Please do share the podcast, leave us a review, and of course, tune in. In the meantime, I leave you with this thought. This year, it's 150 years since Jules Verne published his Around the World in 80 Days. The main fictional character, Phileas Fogg, takes on a transport adventure with all of the modern means of those times. So today, with again the marvellous development of transport that we have now, maybe we can end with a quote from the same author, Jules Verne. I believe that water will one day be employed as fuel, that hydrogen and oxygen, which constitute it, used singly or together, will furnish an inexhaustible source of heat and light, of an intensity of which coal is not capable.